This is the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show number 143. Hi, you're listening to the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. You can find us at pitchvision.com. You can call us on
020-88-167-691.
And you can email us on
coach@pitchvision.com.
My name is David Hinchcliffe, and this week I'm joined by Mark Garraway and Berners. Well, Merry Christmas, everybody. I hope everybody's in the festive spirit, and everyone listening. And Merry Christmas to you, Mark, and Merry Christmas to you, Berners.
Thanks, Merry Coach. Christmas. Merry Christmas, Coach.
I'm recording this in my Santa hat. I've got presents strewn all around me, and there's a star on the Christmas tree. So it's about as far from cricket in this country as we can possibly be, I think.
Yeah, there's plenty of cricket going on around the world though, which doesn't stop for us in our cold weather over here.
No, exactly. Thank goodness for that. It's year round cricket as long as you know where to look. So we've got Big Bash going on, of course, and one thing that I've noticed happening recently in sort of general limited over type stuff is the return of the spinner. So. I just wanted to get a few thoughts, really, on why we all think that the spinner is has come back into fashion in modern limited over cricket.
Well, I think it's a bit of a sort of knock on effect from the 2020, really, and in many ways, it's changed the conventional thinking. You know, 10 years ago, it was maybe play one spinner, play four seamers or three seamers, and then make some overs up out of a couple of batters somewhere along the line. But if you look at it now, 2020's come into play. Spin's become far more important than anybody first said spin was going to be within 2020. And as it has with fielding and some of the shots that we see getting played at all levels of a game and all formats of a game now, spin is now being considered to be a viable option. And it's backed up by the stats. But I just think that people are looking at spin as captaincy and tactical options in a far more positive way than they were sort of 10 years ago before 2020 came into play.
Yeah, it's good. Well, it's obviously easier to control the game, isn't it, with spin, because if you've got a pace conducive pitch, you can quite easily stand there and just, you know, the sorts of paces that these guys are bowling, like Tate and Lee in one day cricket, you can quite easily angle your bat. Even guys further down the order can just get a bit of wood on it, and more times than not, it can race away. So I think the fact that captains can gain a little bit of control from their spinners, and I think it's emphasised by England as well, having someone like Graham Swann. I mean, I'm not quite sure if they didn't have him, whether it would be such a big part of England's game plan, because he's obviously very successful in what he does, and you know what you're going to get with him, and he does it time and time again.
Yeah, I get that. But even before Swann came back into play, I know that we took a decision in 2006-07 before the CB series over in Australia to make sure that Monty played, and Swanee wasn't quite on the radar at that point, but Monty played a huge part in winning that series and then going into the World Cup, and there was a realization already at that time that spin was very, very important within the game, and was only going to become more so. So, yeah, I think Swanee's added the extra dimension to it, but he's a reluctant 50-over bowler. I think he's made that fairly obvious in some of his comments within his book and also, you know, in the press recently, in an article with Paul Newman. But, you know, spin is massively important. As you say, that control is vital.
How important do you think it is for a spinner to bowl in? So, say you've got a game scenario, or you've got an actual game plan, do you think it's dictated more, you know, they're going to always toss the ball to the spinner and see how he goes? Or do you think there's times where people have played spinners and they just haven't bowled due to what's happened in the game? Is that tilting in one certain direction?
Well, I think one day cricket and 2020 cricket, and, you know, as the game gets shorter, it becomes more of a set play game. So you know when spinners are going to bowl in one day cricket and in T20 cricket, you've got that pretty much worked out. So somebody like a Swanee will bowl in certain set periods of a game. I think one of the interesting things for me was watching the India series out in India recently with England, that I honestly thought, and you can't say this about England very often, but I think they got their tactics wrong. And because Swanee hardly bowled in power plays. And we had people like Samet bowling in power plays. And Samet's a useful spin bowler. But to me, you know, when you've got a quality bowler, number one in the world in Graham Swanee, he's got to bowl at the times where the most pressure is on the bowling side. You've got to let him exploit his skills and use his skills at the time where the pressure's on the most. And I think they missed out on an opportunity to get wickets, which is one of their issues out in India. And it would be interesting to see their one-day cricket in the early part of the year next year, to see whether Graham Swan bowls more in the power plays in those sort of conditions.
It shows how important it is for a captain or a management team, if the coach is involved in those kind of decisions, to appreciate a spinner and to know that a spinner can do things that not necessarily a fast bowler can do, you know, especially on flatter wickets or when the ball's not coming onto the bat, or, you know, the times when... not necessarily when the ball's turning square, because that doesn't happen very much at the top level anymore in ODI cricket. So, you know, I think it shows the importance of a captain and a management team who can appreciate the advantages of an attacking spinner, even in a game which is limited in overs, and therefore you would think, well, the spinner always has a defensive role. And that trickles down to the club level, where people see that spinners aren't just, you know, the batsman who can give you a few overs in the middle of an innings, and you know, they can be a important wicket-taking option if they can give the ball a rip. So, you know, hopefully that will bring on spinners for the future as well, who are given a bit more of a chance at lower levels.
Yeah, definitely. And you see that all the way through, don't you? You know, if somebody's a world-class performer, you get kids and you get players mimicking, copying, taking on tactics. And that's why the game's so great, is that we're surrounded by cricket nowadays on the television. The world's a very small place in the cricketing world, because you can watch so much on the internet and on the television. And it's great to see people taking on some of the important lessons that can be learned from watching people like Graham Swan bowling in one-day cricket.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the grassroots stuff, because, Mark, I know you've been doing some coaching in Taunton over the Christmas holiday. So how's that been going? Have there been any things any trends that you've spotted in the youngsters, the talented youngsters that you've been looking at?
Yeah, I mean, I've worked with a huge cross-section of players with different experiences over the course of the last week. We're 2 days in. And it's gone really well, and the feedback that we've had has been excellent. There's some county players in there. There's also some guys that are just enthusiastic and starting out on their journey of playing cricket, and hopefully a lifelong journey of playing cricket. And it's been very interesting in that many of the guys have never seen themselves on video before. So that's one of the things that I've been able to give them over the last couple of days, is to video them on the iPad, to run some analysis over the top of that video, and then email them with some thoughts that we can work on for the remainder of the week. And the feedback from that has just been amazing.
And of course, Pitch Vision soon to be delivered to add to this recipe.
Well, we're very much looking forward to that. That arrives tomorrow, and Friday's session, if any of them are going to be listening to this, will be incorporating some testing done with the Pitch Vision system, and for all of them, they'd have never seen anything like it. So if they've been amazed so far by the things that we've been able to achieve in 2 days, then they won't be able to wait until Friday.
And what kind of things have you been spotting? Are there any particular things which come up again and again in terms of, you know, technical side of things?
Yeah, definitely. One of the most notable things so far has just been a lack of awareness of alignment, really. And when I say alignment, is making sure that all of your energy is going to where you want to bowl the ball, or to put maximum revolutions on the ball if you're a spinner. And so we've done a lot of work in getting people to just realign themselves so that their approach complements their action, which complements where they want the ball to go to, and keep it in as simple terms as that, really. We don't want to get too technical. But we've noticed a lot of them didn't have that awareness, and the aim is by the end of a week to have that awareness and to be able to demonstrate the developments. I mean, from a batting point of view, the interesting thing that I've noted so far is just the approach to nets. We're introducing something tomorrow where every drive shot that has to be played, and it's on quite a slow surface, actually. So every drive shot that gets played, or front foot drive shot in particular, has to bounce before it hits the side netting. So you're encouraging late contacts on the ball because there was a lot of balls going in the air that didn't need to go in the air, really. So we're just trying to introduce some of that precision into it. And if anybody hits one into the net off a half volley tomorrow before it hits the ground, then they're going to be running a three in their pair. So it's not just them that will be knackered, but also their mate at the other end as well. So there's a bit of consequence stuff that's going to be put into it, which will be interesting to see how they go.
Time now for this week's interview, and we've got a slightly unusual part of the world for cricket this week, which is Shanghai in China. And I'm talking to John Newton, who's the founder of N4 Sports, which is an organisation that helps the Chinese Cricket Association develop cricket in a number of ways. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you, David.
So, cricket in China. If you follow cricket very closely, you might have heard mutterings that cricket is a developing sport in China, but generally, it's not seen as a traditional sport of the country. What is Chinese cricket like?
It's been a challenge over the last 4 or 5 years for China to sort of cotton onto the concept of cricket. But in terms of the growth over the last 3 or 4 years, only in Shanghai alone as a city, they've already got 40 school teams. So in terms of the perception, any person who's over 30 years old, because they haven't grown up traditionally with the concept of the sport, it really is non-existent. And to be honest, when we talk about a bat and a ball, the immediate assumption is baseball. But honestly, since the last 4 years and the SCA have become more involved in actually going on to grassroots level in schools, they now actually hold an annual tournament which takes about 2 months of 2020 cricket. And there's about just over 40 teams across elementary school, high schools and universities playing cricket for at least 2 months a year. And if they go to representative cricket, they actually play for their cities. And that sort of filters up into another one-month tournament that they all play each other. And from there, the national team is picked every year. So they have put a structure in place. And in terms of the growth over 4 years, I think it's been quite phenomenal considering the fact that, 3 or 4 or 5 years ago, no one even knew about cricket.
There's been a tradition of cricket being played by the expat population, but the local population are growing into the game as well then?
Yes, I mean the expatriate group have been around since 1885, the Shanghai Cricket Club, which runs its own internal privately run league, and there's about 300 to 350 members, and that's a 16 team league in itself. But slowly, and a lot of credit also goes to the expats, in terms of the uptake from locals, before the official government bodies were actually set up, a lot of the locals who had an interest, they used to come play in the expatriate league. So, for example, a girl by the name of Mei Hua, who's China's most capped cricketer, and she's also the former Chinese cricket captain, she learnt all of her cricket in the expatriate league. And from then, when the national team was structured, she had by far the most experience. So it's the expatriate league was the platform, but now, as I mentioned, there's 40 odd local school teams that have all been developed through these government organisation structures, the CCA and the SCA.
And we often talk about different styles of cricket being played in different parts of the world. You know, there's an English way of playing, there's a subcontinental way of playing. Is there a Chinese style of cricket?
That's a good question, because they have been very honest about where their weakness lies at the moment and where their strength lies at the moment. And funny enough, I suppose there's no real reason, maybe just apart from the fact that it is the most technical aspect of the game, is to learn to bat from scratch and the footwork. But in terms of where Chinese strengths have been, when they've played in international and affiliate tournaments in Asia, their fielding is phenomenal, and they have an abundance of really good fast bowlers. Whereas the batting side of things, that they've got one or two stars, and then those two guys carry the team. But in terms of a Chinese style, it's the fielding and bowling, and there's this energy that they have, and that's sort of where their flair lies at the moment, because they're very athletic. Just by, if you look at the Olympics, so a lot of the energy and just, I think, a lot of the natural talent is sort of sitting in the bowling and the fielding side of the Chinese game at the moment.
So are there any prospects in the fast bowling world? You know, is there going to be somebody who appears bowling at 145 kilometres an hour?
David, to be very honest with you, we don't even have the technology right now to measure some of these guys. But I will say that there's the current Chinese men's team captain. His name is Zhang Yufei, and he actually opens the batting and opens the bowling. He's actually joined one of the expatriates clubs now because he's at a level now where he's almost too good for his local peers. So he's joining our expatriate league to actually play on Sundays and train in the nets with us, as well as actually play with the national team. And just an interesting, you know, little anecdote. When we had a trial game against the national team, one of the expatriate clubs, we had a Ranji Trophy under 21 player who works here face him as an opening batsman, and he walked out and said he hasn't faced the guy that quick in the last 6 years. So, I mean, the guy, like I said, he opens the batting for the national team, he opens the bowling for the national team, and most of us who've all played pretty decent club level cricket in member nations, we really struggle to face him. So you know, and he's 19, he's got a long road ahead of him, but if he keeps it up, who knows, that this guy could become, you know, if we always talk about sports development stories for China, this guy could become the Yao Ming for Chinese cricket if he gets to 25 and he's good enough to actually get a contract somewhere. All of a sudden, you'll find, you know, China looking at only watching the games that he's involved in because they're so proud of their own people. But these kind of guys could actually really drive an interest in the game. And he definitely is a talent. He's 19 years old and he's captaining the national team, opening the batting and bowling for them.
So that's one to watch. But what's the future of the Chinese game in the next 5 years or so? Is there plans afoot for finding a footing for a first-class competition and getting member status?
To be honest, I think to get that in the next 5 years might be a little bit premature. But what they are trying to do is develop university leagues, and in Shanghai I wouldn't say it's strong in terms of standard, but they have the numbers in Shanghai at the moment in terms of the teams. To be honest, what the government is looking at doing, the governing body here is looking at doing, is trying to take the guy I just mentioned, Zhang Yufei, and maybe two or three other guys, and getting them to possibly go and do university exchanges, you know, in any one of the major cricket-playing nations, where these three or four guys can actually go and play in either pretty high-level university standard cricket or potentially first-class cricket, and then bring those skills back. Just in terms of the next 5 years, I think it'd be a long shot to actually get a really solid first class playing tournament going. But there are events that are being looked at, and that would possibly heighten the exposure.
Well, John, it's a interesting time for cricket. So thank you very much for explaining what things are like in China, and maybe not so long we'll be seeing a strong Chinese national team making strides forward.
That'll be great. David, thanks very much for your time. It's been great to be on the show.
Time now for the festive edition of the questions section, and there's absolutely no Christmas themed questions this week because there's not many Christmas themed cricket questions that you can ask, but nevertheless, the two questions that we do have are in the competition this week to win a prize, which is an online coaching course courtesy of Pitch Vision Academy at pitchvision.com. And if you want to send in your question, we'll tell you how to do that later on. But for now, Berners has got a couple of questions for us. So Berners, what's the first one in the mailbag this week?
My first question's from Ben, and he's currently mixing it up in the Alps. He's about 200 kilometres from his nearest club, and he doesn't get back till the end of April, a week into the season, and he's just wondering exactly how he can get back into the swing of things. Quite a common question these days, so a bit of corridor cricket and so on.
Well, I mean, I think there's heaps of things to do, and first thing I will say is that there's absolutely no excuse to go back to playing cricket being anything less than super fit, because there are opportunities at altitude, which he obviously is at, to really work on particularly the CV element of his fitness. So whether it be enjoying the slopes in terms of snowboarding or skiing, or whether it's having the opportunity to do do some running out on the roads and getting some running shoes that have got spikes on them if you're on the snow and ice. And it's something that, that I've actually done whilst I've been away on ski trips as well. So there's just a great opportunity to get out there. You know, the weather, admittedly a bit cold, is normally very clear for long parts of a day, and get out there and get the CV done. So that's the first thing. Fitness can't go down the wayside, really. And as we've discussed in other podcasts, there are so many things that can be done with your own body weight as well. So you don't necessarily need a gym, but if there is a gym, fantastic. But your own body weight in terms of press ups and dips and squats and all sorts of things like that. I mean, there's no excuse why you can't go back in better physical condition than you left the end of last season. So that's the first point I'd make.
I think probably I would add to that there's lots of things you can do to work on your mental approach as well. You know, building up your confidence. You know, we talk about the bank account, making deposits in the bank account of confidence, and those things that we've mentioned before. All those things you can do anywhere. You know, you can imagine a perfect, and you can sit down and imagine a perfect innings, whether there's 6 feet of snow outside or whether it's blazing sunshine. So the only difference is you probably want to sit by the fire if you're it got 6 feet of snow outside. So certainly there's things you can work on the mental side of the game, even when you're not picking up a bat or a ball. But it is a difficult one, because there is a fair chance that unless you're some kind of physical genius, that you're going to be struggling when you come back to the UK and find yourself wondering what a cricket bat looks like. So there are lots of things you can do, but I think none of them are going to be ideal, right, Mark? I mean, you know, there's if you're not practicing your cricket, there's going to be some kind of fallback, isn't there?
Yeah, there will be. But again, the research that goes on about what you've been talking about there, the mental side of the game is significant. And, you know, there's players that have actually built technical competencies without actually hitting a ball or bowling a ball or throwing or catching or kicking a ball in other different sports. And the key to it really is to believe what you're thinking by creating as much realism around your visualization as possible. And that's why actual events are really useful to use within visualization. It's very difficult to associate yourself into a mental image if you haven't experienced it yourself in any way, shape or form. So as much as it's lovely to believe that we're going to be playing at the MCG, unless you've been there and you can associate the sights, the smells and the feelings that come from playing there, it's probably not that useful to put it in to a bit of visualization. But if you're at your club side, you know your club ground, and you can put actual innings and actual sights, smells, feelings, and associate those into your visualization, and it can become very, very powerful indeed. And so the more associated you can make yourself into your visualizations, the better.
It's an interesting area for me as well, the whole idea of sort of being undercooked and that side of things, where, you know, you look at somebody like Glenn McGrath a few years ago in the Ashes when England lost 5-0. You know, he came back from a very, very long layoff and just started taking wickets straight away, and nobody said he was undercooked. And then Steve Harmison, of course, probably the classic in the other direction, where everybody said he was undercooked, and it takes him, you know, bowling a lot more overs, it seems, before he's sort of back into the swing of things. So what is causing that in your mind, do you think, Mark? Is it just a combination of lots of different factors all coming together? Why are some people more undercooked than others?
Well, a lot of it is a massive correlation between physicality and your physical presence and your mental presence. I mean, that's been proven and documented down the years. And if you look at those two examples, you know, Steve Harmison, when he was at his best, 2004 to end of 2005, where he was ranked the best bowler in the world and certainly in the top three, was at the peak of his physical prowess. He'd done lots of training with Nigel Stockhill, but also with Newcastle Football Club. And I think he could have taken a bit of a layoff in that period and still come back and produce the results that we saw in that period. So when Glenn McGrath came back, he'd been conditioning himself for 15 years. And the more conditioned you are, the easier it is to take a layoff, whether it be in the Alps or whether it be, you know, rehabilitating from an injury. And you find that the people that come back the quickest and the best, and almost as if they haven't been away, are the ones that have got good conditioning history.
But there's a mental side to it as well. I mean, Steve Harmison sort of being a bad tourist was a well-documented thing in the press. Do you have to have that kind of bulletproof self-confidence to go with that as well? Did you just think to yourself, well, I'm just going to go out there and do what I've done in the past successfully, and you don't worry about it, and that kind of it becomes self-fulfilling?
Yeah, I'm sure that, I mean, if you take Harmy's example, I'm sure that, you know, not really enjoying being on tour was part of it. But actually, by the time that 2006-07 came around, he'd had quite a lot of experience of being on tour. And also the England management that I was in had set up a number of things which was there to try and help him. He had brilliant support from his mate Andrew Flintoff. You know, that was all part of a strategic plan of how we used to stick them next to each other in rooms and created almost a home from home experience for Harmy, with his dartboard and his computer games and him being the sort of hub of the social stuff. So I think he was pretty robust from a mental point of view, but the issue being is I don't think he trusted himself physically, you know. And when you've got speed guns on you all day long, and one of the things that you were noted for was bowling at 93 miles an hour when you're at your best, and then you're knocking out 85 mile an hour at best in those series, there's evidence all the time that you're not hitting your straps. And that's where the physical conditioning comes in. Where does confidence come from? It comes from doing your preparation. It comes from being as fit as you can. And it comes from thinking as positively as you possibly can. And if one of those is out of sync, then it's very, very difficult for you to be robust. Yeah, have robust confidence running through your body.
Yeah, and I think that is a very personal thing, isn't it? Some people just have that confidence kind of built into them, don't they? They don't need a lot of time to work on it as such. They don't need to have a lot of special measures. They just bounce back from these things. And, you know, Ian Botham, famous, of course, for always finding something else to blame whenever he failed, because it couldn't possibly have been anything to do with him doing anything wrong. That kind of personality, compared with somebody who maybe needs a little bit more security and a little bit more confidence building, those you have to know your own personality, don't you? And if you're sort of stuck in the Alps for months, then you have to know how you're going to react when you get back, if you want to start where you left off and succeed again, right?
You do. I would say that the Ian Botham psychology is an anomaly as opposed to a norm. Yeah. And when I say an anomaly, I mean in a minute amount of the population. And if you've done your research and you know that that's what he used to do, and everything was everybody else's fault and not his, and it protected his self-confidence. There are only very few people that have actually done that. McEnroe being another example of that, that used to use that particular strategy to maintain his self-confidence. But there's very few that work like that. So in the main, certainly the people that I've worked with, the harder you work, the more robust your confidence is, and the smarter you work, the more robust your confidence is. And it's when that self-doubt, because I haven't done it, comes into play, that the confidence is very easily eroded.
Yeah, that really is the key, isn't it? You know, you have to, however much work you do, at the end of it, you have to think to yourself, I've done the work that I need to do, and I feel confident that I can go out there and perform.
Correct. And then the Olympics is going to be brilliant next year, because there's going to be so many sound bites from guys that have put 4, 8, 12 years worth of preparation into going there. And yes, their eyes on the medals, but ultimately they won't assess themselves on their medals so much. They'll say, right, was there anything else I could have done? And the Olympic ideology behind it is, as long as I've done all of the preparation that I've done, and I've done it to the best of my ability, then the result will fall into place. And if it doesn't, then I've still done everything to maintain my confidence. And there's going to be a million sound bites from the Olympics next year along those lines. And the best players that I've worked with, although they might not be that public with it, that's definitely the way that they go about their business.
Our next question is from Gagan, and he's just having a bit of difficulty playing on the leg side against fast bowlers. Quite a common occurrence, especially for us left-handers. I was told it was all about getting your guard right and getting your head central and getting that positioned over the ball. But be interesting to hear your guys' thoughts on that as well.
Well, although it's quite a general question and it's a difficult one to answer specifically for Gagan, I think generally speaking, if someone has trouble playing on the leg side, it tends to be something to do with the balance. You know, maybe they're, you know, for right-handed batsmen, is tipping a little bit over towards the offside, then you know, they can get caught playing around their pad and they think the ball's, because they're not lined up to the ball properly, they think it's in one place, in fact it's in another place, and they end up getting out LBW playing around the front pad a little bit. So I think really, if you're looking for a single word answer, I would say that balance is the word, because the head plays the an all important role in batting, because it's very heavy and it's right at the top of your body. So if you get the weight of the head in the wrong place in any direction, the ball's not going to go exactly where you want it to go. So the first thing I'd probably look at is to see whether that player, when the ball is straight or going a little down the leg side, he's keeping his head going forwards towards the ball rather than leaning over towards the offside.
Yeah, and allied to that is your positioning as well. And you know, a lot of players who struggle, and I'll talk about somebody like Phil Hughes here. You can bowl overly straight at him because his leg side game isn't as good as his offside game, which is phenomenal. So it's about position on the crease, and he tends to hold himself on leg stump. So his head will be over the top of leg stump, which makes an off stump ball actually a ball that he can punish, because he creates whip for himself. So that positioning in relation to the stumps is something that often prevents somebody from being good on the leg side. So somebody like Sachin Tendulkar, whose head will be over middle and off stump, is a very good player hitting through the leg side, because his head is always in line with the ball that's anywhere near the stumps. Whereas Virender Sehwag will hold himself on leg stump a little bit more and punish anything through the offside. So to me, you can balance is important, but it's also allied to your position, because you can be balanced and take a leg stump guard, but you're not going to be as good through the leg side as somebody who takes a middle and off or middle stump guard.
Yeah, and I suppose related to that would be where the bat gets picked up as well, because if someone is picking up the bat over, say, leg stump, that's going to make it a lot harder to play through the leg side.
Yeah, well, you've got to come all round your body and your pad, haven't you? And guys who play, who hit the ball, pick their bat up over the top of leg stump or behind themselves, are generally really good players through the covers, because a straight downswing from that position goes to extra cover, really. And you see a lot of left-handers do that. They pull their bat behind them, and it's a real telltale thing for a coach. And something that you can work on very easily. Even Marcus Trzaskowski, great Marcus Trzaskowski, if anything went wrong in his technique, it would always be the area that we'd look at to see whether that bat was disappearing slightly behind him, and then he was struggling to access the ball that was sort of middle and leg and hitting it through the leg side. So yeah, that's very important to keep an eye on as well. You want to have access to the ball irrespective of where it is in relation to your body.
And you do see that quite a lot. You do see players who have a favourite cover drive, and they're kind of thinking about it even before the bowler bowls, which is which we've talked about before, haven't we? You've already got a shot in mind as the bowler's running in, because it's your good shot, and you know it'll get your boundary. You know it looks good. So there are a lot of people kind of are thinking towards playing that cover drive, and then naturally they. You know, maybe stand a little bit too sideways. Maybe they're leaning over a little bit too much. Maybe the bat's going over middle and leg, something like that. And then it's all coming from the mentality of, rather than thinking I'm going to play in the V and, you know, play off my legs and hit ball through mid wicket if I can by turning the face of the bat. Those kind of shots. You're thinking I'm going to hit it somewhere between point and mid off. Then very quickly. A decent bowler and a decent captain will pick up on that and cut off your scoring shots and bowl in areas where you can't score, and you're going to struggle.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, I mean, to me, it's fairly simple. You get your positioning right. You try and keep your head over your feet for as long as you possibly can when you move into a ball and when you're striking the ball, and you'll find that you can access the ball through the leg side a little bit easier.
Soapbox time on the show, and every week we get a minute dedicated to somebody who has something particular to say about a subject to do with cricket coaching or playing. We had a fabulous rant last week from Berners, so Mark this week is going to have a go to see if he can match the standards of Berners' angry voice. But Mark, don't get too cross, because it is a time of good cheer for us all. So a minute on a subject of your choice. Over to you, Gareth.
I'm going to go about poor language, and I don't mean swearing, but also that it's the use of language and what it tells us. And the word that I'm going to pick on today as part of my soapbox is the word try. And I absolutely hate the word try, and I don't let any of my players talk about trying something, because to me, you either do something or you do not do something. You don't try it. So if somebody says, oh, I'm going to try and bowl my slower ball to this batter, then they're giving themselves the option of not getting it right and getting smacked away for four or six. So to me, as the great Yoda in Star Wars said, there is do or do not, there is no try. So if you hear your player say, I'm going to try and do something, then you question them about whether they're actually going to do it or not. Equally, as a coach, if you're saying to somebody, try this or try that, then you've got to give more commitment and say, do this and do that.
Okay, so that's the end of the show, and in fact, it's the last show of the year for us. We're going to be taking a 2-week Christmas break for the Pitch Vision Academy cricket show. So I know there's a lot of people out there who's going to be very disappointed to miss the show over the festive period, but there's lots of things that you can be getting on with in the meantime. I'm sure you've got presents to wrap and things like that. So we won't be bothering you for the next 2 weeks, but we'll be coming back with a big fanfare in the new year in time for our pre-season special for everybody in the Northern Hemisphere, which is going to be quite exciting for all of us to start thinking about cricket again when it's dark at 4 o'clock. Nobody wants to be thinking about cricket, but hope springs eternal with us. So before we go, we have to decide on a winner for the show. Berners has already dashed off. He's had a train to catch. He's on his way home. He's driving home for Christmas, as the song goes. Well, someone's driving him. He's on the train. But so we'll say Merry Christmas to Berners, and we'll decide on a competition winner. So Mark, we've got the two questions. Ben in the Alps and Gagan. With his leg side play. So which is the best question for you this week?
I'm going to go with Gagan, because developing one's leg side game is really important nowadays, particularly one day cricket, and as we know for right handers, 60 to 65% of runs are scored on the leg side, so it's an important thing for people to start working on.
Well, there's with restrictions and things, it's just there's less people over there, isn't there? So, it makes sense to...
Well, my dad always said to me, it's very important that you get your leg side play, because you've only got to miss three fielders instead of five. Play for a lot of the time than spot on.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot more gaps. So, well done, Gagan. Merry Christmas to you. There's a Christmas present for you to enjoy. And if you want to send in your own question, then we will be stockpiling them over the Christmas period. So don't be afraid. Send in your questions to us. And you can do that in a couple of different ways. Mark, you'll have to do the stand-in role for Berners this week. So what are those contact details for people to get in touch with us and send us their Christmas presents?
On email, it's coach@pitchvision.com. And on the phone, it's 0208 816 7691.
Yes, indeed. Twitter will still run over Christmas. It's at PV Cricket Coach. And Facebook, well, we'll always be there. Just do a search for Pitch Vision Academy. You can subscribe to the show, so when we do come back, you don't have to miss an edition. Head over to iTunes and search for Pitch Vision Academy, and you'll find us in there. And if you don't want to use iTunes, you can head over to pitchvision.com/academy, find the podcast, you'll see the feed in there, so you can put that into whatever you like. I've got it in my tablet, and I've got it on my phone, so I can listen to myself over and over again and enjoy the sound of my own voice. I don't know if you do that as well, do you, Mark?
No.
Well, obviously, you're not as much of an egomaniac as I am.
No, mate. I hear myself enough, and... I hope everybody else enjoys it, but I don't need to listen to it.
Well, I edit the show as well, of course, so I get to listen to myself at least three times every single show. So that's an hour and a half well spent every week, I think. So that's it for Christmas. We want to wish everyone who's listened to the show any time during the last 12 months a very, very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And we will see you on the other side with a brand new season of the Pitch Vision Academy Cricket Show. So until then, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year. Cheers, Gareth.
Cheers, David. Have a good one, mate.